Mr. Nemser, I apologize. I keep forgetting the facilities are much further away for counsel than they are for us.
No problem, Your Honor. I'm sorry if there was a delay. Paul Nemser for the Fidelity Parties, Your Honor. I would request 2 minutes for rebuttal time.
Certainly.
Okay. This case involves Section 806 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Statute, which is entitled Protection of Employees of Publicly Traded Companies Who Report Evidence of Fraud, and it creates a cause of action which is subcaptioned Whistleblower Protection for Employees of Publicly Traded Companies. And Fidelity's position here is that indeed this statute applies to protect employees of publicly traded companies, but not to employees of privately held contractors or subcontractors such as Ms. Lawson and Mr. Zhang here. The district court, Judge Woodlock, ruled that the statute does apply to privately held contractor or subcontractor employees if their whistleblowing activity was related to evidence of, was related to fraud against shareholders. And we ask that the court reverse and rule that the statute does not apply to employees of privately held contractors or subcontractors. There are a number of arguments in the brief, but there are three points that I'd like to emphasize today. The first is that Fidelity's interpretation is the best interpretation under the language, the title of the statute, the legislative history. Second, that Fidelity's is the only interpretation before you that draws a clean, simple, workable line for this statute, that there are a number of other interpretations that have been put before you, but they lead to inconsistencies and absurd results. And third, to highlight the line of securities cases that most recently, and the example is the Janus Capital case the Supreme Court decided just this year. It's a mutual fund case, and it requires that clean lines be drawn to define the scope of civil liability and clear articulation of the categories of potential civil litigants. So the first point.
Can I just try a hypothetical that I think goes to all three of your points?
Sure.
I'd rather, instead of Fidelity, let's call it the mutual funds under the Investment Company Act of 1940 with its board of trustees, than the investment advisors who don't meet the first two criteria under Section 806.
Okay.
Suppose the Board of Trustees were to direct the advisors, we want you to fire individual X because he has been whistleblowing. What then occurs with this statute?
Well, there is a line of cases that says cases, administrative decisions, that says that in a situation where the privately held contractor or subcontractor is acting as an agent of, at the direction of the publicly held entity on the employment matter,
right,
that would be covered. But we're not talking about any allegation even remotely like that here.
Yes. So, in fact, the certified question that comes to us is against that background assumption that we don't have any issue like that before us.
I think that's true, Your Honor. There is no issue like that before you.
Okay.
So what you've got is a statute which spells out who's prohibited from retaliation and who's protected from retaliation. As to who's prohibited from retaliation, it says the public company or any officer, employee, contractor, subcontractor, or agent of the public company. With respect to who's protected from retaliation, all it says is an employee. It doesn't admittedly say an employee of the public company. But it certainly doesn't say, and it would be absurd if it did say, an employee of the public company or any officer, employee, contractor, subcontractor, or agent of the public company, because employees don't have employees. Officers are not going to have employees. And so that would be a misreading of the statute and the language favors Fidelity's interpretation. It's clear enough you could decide on the language alone. But when you get to the other potential guides to interpretation, it becomes perhaps even clearer. The title of the statute, as I've said, is Protection of Employees of Publicly Traded Companies Who Report Evidence of Fraud. The subcaption, Whistleblower Protection of Publicly Traded Company Employees, in essence. So the district court disregarded those titles and the caption on the basis that those things were shorthand. But if Congress had intended shorthand that was going to suggest a wider scope than employees of publicly traded companies, Congress could easily have called it Protection of Employees Who Report Evidence of Fraud, or Whistleblower Protection for Employees. Or, if Congress had had that kind of an intent, it could have been more specific and said, for example, Whistleblower Protection for Employees of Publicly Traded Companies and Other Entities, or something of that kind. Congress could have gone shorter, and it could have gone longer, but it stayed with the phrase employees of publicly traded companies twice over. And the reason for that, I submit, is that this is what the statute is about, encouraging employees of publicly traded companies to come forward. So the title supports Fidelity's interpretation. So does the legislative history.
What do you say to their argument that it's... since Congress was concerned with securities fraud writ large, it's kind of an odd omission to leave out investment advisors to mutual funds. Since mutual funds don't have employees, just about everybody understands that. And it would, if you will, undersell, be under-inclusive to read the statute your way?
Well, multiple answers. First of all, the...
I'm put you in a difficult position. I'm sorry. I don't mean the statutory language. What I mean is the policy choices underlying this act.
Right. Well, to go to the end point here, the Janus Capital case,
Yeah. What
Janus Capital says, that it actually is dealing with an argument which is structured very similarly to the argument that Your Honor just implicitly included in the question, and which the plaintiffs, and to some extent Judge Woodlock, were making here. And that is that... In Janus Capital, the argument was, well, there's an investor protection purpose, and there is a unique, close relationship between the investment advisor and the investment company. And because of that, where there's a false or misleading statement in a fund's prospectus, under Rule 10b-5, you should construe, where the advisor actually put it in there as part of a preparation, you should construe that... Under 10b-5 as being a statement made by the advisor. And the Supreme Court said no. The Supreme Court said you've got to maintain that line, and that investor protection purpose can't be read to override everything else here. And the court said any reapportionment of liability as between an investment advisor and an investment company, that's for Congress, not the courts. And furthermore, here you've got an argument that is structurally quite similar. You've got the argument that, okay, there's an investor protection purpose here, and there's a unique setup between mutual funds and their investment advisor. And because of those things, you ought to read Section 806. You basically ought to drive the interpretation of Section 806 as to subcontractors and contractors that are privately held based on this unique structure in the mutual fund. And we would say, no, that's exactly what Janus Capital says you don't do. And Your Honor have quoted Stone Ridge in the past. It has similar types of language. Pinter v. Dahl, which is an express remedy case, similar kinds of language. You can't let the investor protection purpose override everything else. Now, when you get to the legislative history, it's instructive on this point, too, because Congress did not, in the legislative history, as far as we've been able to tell, talk, when it was talking about Sarbanes-Oxley, talk about potential fraud by mutual funds, fraud by investment advisors. That's not what they talk about. What they talk about over and over again is employees of publicly traded companies. The model they use over and over again is Sharon Watkins of Enron, an employee of Enron who eventually blew the whistle. She's an employee of the publicly traded company. That's what Congress was focused on. Now, there's some interesting subsequent legislative history that we talk about in the brief. Well, I'll take a second to talk about the actual legislative history for Sarbanes-Oxley. It emanated, 806 emanated from the Judiciary Committee. It was drafted by Senator Leahy and Senator Grassley. In the Judiciary Committee report, among other places, there are a lot of places where it says things like this, but the Judiciary Committee report, the Senate said, well, that's going to be our guide to legal interpretation of the statute. And in the section-by-section analysis, it says this section would provide whistleblower protection to employees of publicly traded companies. And not to go into any detail about what's in the legislative history, because it is fully briefed in the papers, but one other example, which this court actually quoted in Carnero, right after Sarbanes-Oxley was passed, Senator Leahy was addressing a question about what the proper interpretation was. I think it was within a day or two of Sarbanes-Oxley. And he put in the congressional record a statement which focused on Sharon Watkins, said the law was designed to protect people like Sharon Watkins from Enron, and then goes on a little later to say, the law was intentionally written to sweep broadly, protecting any employee of a publicly traded company who took such reasonable action like Sharon Watkins did, to try to protect investors and the market. So again, the focus on publicly traded companies. Now, this subsequent legislative history is instructive too, because, as I said, in the legislative history for Sarbanes-Oxley itself, which was passed in 2002, you don't have references to mutual fund fraud or investment advisor fraud. Whereas the next year, Congress saw a lot of bills that related to mutual funds, and one of those was called the Mutual Fund Reform Act, and it would have expressly altered Section 806 to include employees of investment advisors, and that didn't pass. And then, over the next several years, a number of decisions were made at the judicial level and at the administrative level. And what you had as of 2010, when the Dodd-Frank Amendment was considered, was essentially this: a conflict in the authorities as to whether a privately held subsidiary was covered by Section 806, and also a conflict in the authorities, if you include Judge Woodlock's decision, which had come down a couple of months before Congress passed Dodd-Frank, a conflict in the authorities saying as to whether the employees of a privately held contractor or subcontractor would be covered. So you had two conflicts. And Congress, in Dodd-Frank, amends Section 806, and it resolves the conflict as to the privately held subsidiaries. It says certain privately held subsidiaries whose finances are rolled up in the consolidated financial statement are included under 806 expressly. And Congress does not address the privately held contractor or subcontractor issue. So you have further evidence in the legislative history that Fidelity's interpretation is right. Now, this set of points that I just made, the language, the title, the legislative history, they, I think, compel the conclusion Fidelity's interpretation is right. If you agree with that, then under your case, Sucker v. Ashcroft, you don't ever have to get to a deference issue, and there are a lot of deference arguments floating around in the various briefs on the other side. And Judge Woodlock refused to accord any deference to the agency to the extent he addressed the issue, but at any rate, you don't have to go there at all under Sucker.
And I'll admit, maybe a mistake was made in the Day case that I wrote, so you don't have to convince us on that.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. So The bottom line here is that you've got the language, the title, the legislative history saying Fidelity's is the best interpretation. And then on the other side, you have a whole plethora of additional possible interpretations being put forward. In fact, I've counted 9 different proposed interpretations in the various briefs, and if you include what the district court did.
Can I just ask you a factual question about the model that we have before us? This model where the publicly traded corporation has no employees whatsoever and relies solely on private entities, is this a model that predates Enron?
It does, Your Honor. It's one of the ways that mutual funds have been organized under the 40 Act, Investment Company Act.
This is not something that sprang up to avoid the requirements of 306, in your opinion?
No, certainly not, Your Honor. And I mean, this model has preexisted. But it's worth noting, and we said this in our brief, that it's not the only model under which mutual funds are organized. And there are many mutual funds that have publicly held investment advisors. So to the extent the argument has been made that there would be a gap that would be completely unfilled under Section 806, a lot of mutual funds would be covered, but these particular mutual funds would not.
Why? Why do they organize one way as opposed to the other?
I don't know, Your Honor, to tell you the truth. I would like to say a little more about these inconsistencies. There are something like 9 different views put forward in the various briefs of plaintiffs and their amici and the district court. And the sheer number of these inconsistencies argues for Fidelity's position and the simplicity of Fidelity's position, because these are hard to apply. And you can see that in a couple of examples, which I'd like to call the court's attention to. The first is with the district court, and the second is with the SEC. In the district court, Judge Woodlock initially said in his opinion that the statute was limited to whistleblower protection for employees of publicly traded companies. I'm sorry, whistleblowing activity involving fraud against shareholders. Whistleblowing activity involving fraud against shareholders. That's what he said. Interestingly, when he put the certified question to you, he changed it. And he said whistleblowing activity involving fraud against shareholders of the publicly traded company. And it's probably no accident that he did that, because otherwise you have this statute potentially applying to whistleblowers who report a fraud in a privately held little subcontractor. And that's pretty far from the types of concerns that were animating Sarbanes-Oxley. So that's one example.
And finish your thought. And
okay. And the second example there with the SEC is the SEC puts forward a different standard, that is the whistleblowing activity has to involve a report of a violation by the public company. Well, if you take a look at the footnote in the SEC's brief that describes what they think Ms. Lawson has alleged, which I think is footnote 6 on page 5 in their brief, you'll see that every single one of the things that they talk about is an alleged wrong by the investment advisor, not by the public company, which is the mutual fund. So they seem to be arguing that Ms. Lawson would be included under the statute, and yet their own principle would seem to exclude her. So those are the kind of absurd results that arise here. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Talwani.
Good morning. I represent plaintiff Jackie Hosung Lawson, and Jonathan Zhang has ceded Ms. Lawson his argument time.
Yes.
Sarbanes-Oxley was enacted in the wake of Enron, and it was enacted with a very strong, if not unanimous, voting in the Congress. And it is a very broad law. We would submit that this case falls directly in the center of what Congress was trying to get at. And it falls directly within the plain language of this statute. And while there may be questions of where the edges of the statute covers, I would submit respectfully that those are not the questions before you. There are three prongs to this analysis that we all go back and forth on. The one question is, who are the actors? Who can be sued? And we actually don't seem to have any direct disagreement here. It is a publicly traded company, companies on the stock exchange. It is companies who are required to file certain reports. Those are your mutual funds. It's now, after the Dodd-Frank amendments, statistical rating organizations. And it's the officers, employees, contractors, subcontractors, and agents. And everyone agrees that those are the actors who may not retaliate against protected whistleblowers. The second question is, what is the protected whistleblowing? And there was a line there that Judge Woodlock raised, and we can go there or not. But the third question, I think, is the most interesting question here, which is, who is protected? And my brother starts his brief and starts his argument with here with a sentence saying that the whistleblowers are, the employees are employees of the public company. But that's not a quote from the statute. The statute protects an employee. The statute lists employees, agents, officers, subcontractors of such companies. But it simply lists an employee as the protected whistleblower. And I think it, what's interesting is if you, and this is perhaps the question that you started with, Judge Lynch, if you question what happens, starting with the simple point of the public company. The public company has a, and we don't need to be dealing with a mutual fund, just an ordinary publicly traded company. And the publicly traded company has its inside audit people, and it has an outside auditor that it's required to have by law, by the securities laws. And the two, the inside auditor and the outside Arthur Andersen equivalent, discover that there's fraud. Under the interpretation, the limiting principle that my brother would have you adopt, an employee has miraculously been limited to an employee of the publicly traded company. So if that internal person is willing to come forward, they would be protected. But if the employee of the outside external auditor required by the securities laws comes forward, and they are either, and keep it again, the simple, forget about who else could be sued, but the publicly traded company is unhappy with that result, as apparently Enron was when Arthur Andersen came forward with things, or maybe it was just Arthur Andersen. But if they're unhappy with it and they want to get rid of that individual or have the outside auditor get rid of that individual, under my brother's analysis, an employee, even though Congress didn't do it, would be limited, would not include that person. I would submit that the term an employee is without ambiguity. I would compare it to other statutes. An employee under the Family and Medical Leave Act, an employee under the National Labor Relations Act.
Don't go there. I mean, the argument's in the brief, but I don't think that that really helps you. We've got a very specific statute and statutory scheme here. Just you can spend your time on it if you want, but I don't think that helps.
The statute, thank you. I would suggest that while I, in our brief, we in our complaint, we alleged that she was protected as an employee of the contractor, not just any employee out there. The regulations of the Department of Labor
right.
Are don't include just employees of the employer and employees of the contractor, but also any employee to whom those actors could affect their employment. And I would suggest that that is consistent with the intention that for starting again just with the publicly traded company, in order to ensure that there is whistleblowing that would bring forward the types of things that happened with Enron, you want to make sure that those employees, whether it's an independent contractor, whoever, are covered. The reason that we keep hearing publicly traded, employees of publicly traded companies, is not from the statutory language itself, it's from the title. And the first problem, besides the question of whether you would use it if it's plain, but moving to the assumption that we would want to look at it, is that it says publicly traded companies. Companies that are required to file these reports under 15D are not publicly traded companies. So I think just from that, we know that this was shorthand. And what this court said in Carnero, and I acknowledge that this was opining on a question not directly before it, but what this court said was if there was an agent, an employee of an agent, one of those listed groups, who was alleging an action, it could be conceived of as an employee of the publicly traded company. I think, with all due respect, the problem, and again, my brother has really pointed out this anomaly, and I think the answer isn't the one that he would suggest. The anomaly is the list of actors. The publicly traded company, the 15D, the employee, officer, agent, subcontractor, contractor. And my brother would suggest that you can't look at that list and say that all of these people have employees. And they're correct. You can't look at it for that purpose. You can look at it as the DOL did, that's the list of people who could affect a whistleblower's employment, and that's a limiting principle. But there's something those people all have in common, and that is that those are the people charged under our securities laws with doing the things and complying with those securities laws that the whistleblowing would have something to do with. Those companies are regulated. Their officers, their employees are regulated by the securities laws. And that's the common theme. And here, if you look, if you look at Air 21, which was the Wendell Holmes Air Safety Aviation Act, it was adopted 2 years before. It was the statute that Congress had most recently used to address whistleblower protections for non-federal employees.
There's an argument that statute, though, contained in it a self-limiting principle, which therefore the language in that statute about employee has to be read in light of the self-limiting principle. We don't have a self-limiting principle in the statute here, although Judge Woodlock tried very hard to come up with one. And therefore, you can't use the larger definition. So what's your response?
I think that's very much to the point. In the Air 21, you have the same parallel statute. You have a no actor may discriminate against an employee. And the actor in Air 21 is the airline carrier and its subcontractor. And then when you go to the bottom of the statute, it defines subcontractor. And it says a subcontractor is the person, not the person who's performing labor relations. It's the person who's performing air safety. And if you look, and you realize that was how it was defined there, and you look at this analogy for no one of these actors.
Okay, I got it.
And it's a strange point on the, a strange connection to the wire, mail, and bank fraud? Because I've been puzzling, what does that have to do with anything? Why do we care about it? And one argument is simply, well, this was a statute that was trying to do a lot of things. But the other is, again, if you look at employees, officers, and the public company itself, they are required under securities laws to disclose their bank and wire fraud convictions. And they're required to do that. They're required to do that because it's a matter of integrity. And that's the connection. The connection is that the people charged under the security laws to be performing this. I understand that my brother suggests that I am making up all of these theories, and I am making up all of these limitations. But I would respectfully submit that this case, which is involving where American investors have their money in the mutual fund industry, and where the employer is essentially saying there are no whistleblower protections for internal whistleblowing that you can use because we are a contractor. And even though the statute says contractor and any contractor and an employee, even though you fall directly within it, because we can find an extreme situation which is not in front of the court, therefore we're not going to apply it here where it would protect American investors.
Can we step back for a minute? Many states do have whistleblower protection acts. Would the Massachusetts statute cover this?
No.
And that is because?
This doesn't fall within any Massachusetts, any specific Massachusetts statute that I know of.
Suppose the violation weren't, as to which there was whistleblowing, was also a violation of state securities laws. Frequently they are quite parallel.
It could be, but that was something that was directly addressed in the Enron, in the Sarbanes-Oxley legislative history.
That works both ways. In Sarbanes-Oxley, what the argument goes, what concerned them most was not investment companies and investment company advisors. It was these large publicly traded hot stock companies, and that was the primary impetus for it. And had they intended to include investment advisors, they would have given them the sort of special treatment that accountants and attorneys and some of the others got. So what's the response to that argument?
The response is that they were not directly focused on mutual funds, but that they passed a law that covered it, and that if you find what Fidelity is suggesting here, you have stripped whistleblower protections from the attorneys, auditors, these outside entities that they were clearly extremely concerned about. They were concerned about Arthur Andersen. I will agree that they weren't talking about mutual funds, but they were talking about Arthur Andersen. They were talking about the partner for Arthur Andersen who lost his position. They were talking about shredding of documents at Arthur Andersen. They created these entities. They took a lot of steps within Sarbanes-Oxley, and they used contractor and subcontractor. And I would respectfully suggest that there is not a single wisp of anything in the legislative language, in the statute itself, or in the legislative history to have the demarcation of which contractors are included and which contractors are not included to be the question of whether they perform labor relations functions. That's not what it's about. That's not why agents, employees, officers are listed. It's not labor relations functions. It's discriminating against whistleblowers. And these are the people that they have to worry might want to discriminate against whistleblowers because these are the people with obligations under the securities laws. I want to just say one quick note about Dodd.
So do you disagree with the DOL interpretation that a contractor is acting as a direct agent of a publicly traded company in order to terminate an employee?
No, I absolutely would agree with it.
Well, the logic of your argument goes in an entirely different direction.
I would say that the statute the statute did not limit it in any way. I would suggest that the limit to labor relations is derived from from nowhere, and that agent, contractor, subcontractor, any agent, any contractor, any subcontractor are as broad terms as you could possibly put. I am submitting only that when you look and you say, what is it that these people have together, I would respectfully suggest it is the same thing that the contractor and subcontractor and airlines do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Mary Reeser. I represent the Secretary of Labor. It is the position of the Secretary that an employee of a public company's contractor, subcontractor, or agent is protected under Section 806 of Sarbanes-Oxley, and furthermore, that fraud against shareholders is not a necessary element of protected activity. Congress delegated authority to enforce Section 806 of Sarbanes-Oxley to the Secretary of Labor. The Department issued procedural regulations consistent with the statutory text, defining the term employee as an individual presently or formerly working for a company or a company representative, or an individual whose employment could be affected by a company or a company representative. The regulations then proceeded to define company representative as any officer, employee, contractor, subcontractor, or agent of a company. The preamble to the regulation states that an employee of a contractor, subcontractor, or agent is protected just as an employee of a public company is protected. The Administrative Review Board of the Labor Department engages in formal adjudication and issues decisions on behalf of the Secretary of Labor. Its decisions are entitled to deference. The board ruled in Johnson v. Siemens Building Technologies that employees of contractors, subcontractors, and agents are protected when they engage in whistleblowing activity. The board based its interpretation on the text of the statute as well as the legislative history. The board said that Congress intended not only to protect employees of publicly traded companies, but also to protect employees of certain private firms that work with or contract with publicly traded companies. Certainly, the legislative history, as has been pointed out, reveals that Congress passed the Sarbanes-Oxley Act in the wake of the Enron scandal, and the legislative history indicates that Congress was not only concerned with the public company Enron, but also with other contractors and agents that worked with Enron, and including Arthur Andersen, other accounting firms and law firms, consultants who were paid millions of dollars to advise Enron. Congress wanted to encourage employees to come forward with information that they might have that would reveal corporate fraud in publicly traded companies and these various other entities that work with the publicly traded companies. Congress wanted to prevent corporate fraud and malfeasance, discover it, and prosecute corporate fraud, and that is why Congress included a very robust whistleblower provision that should be broadly interpreted. Should the court conclude that only employees of publicly traded companies are protected from retaliation, there would be a gaping hole in whistleblower protection under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Employees not only of investment advisors to mutual funds, but also the employees of accountants, attorneys, and consultants.
Can I just put a hypothetical? Suppose the subcontractor is someone who delivers coffee, outside vendor delivers coffee. They're supposed to unobtrusively bring the coffee in, take it out, protect the privacy of the communications they hear in the boardroom. The employee comes out and says to the coffee company. I didn't like what I heard. And the coffee company says, hey, wait a minute, you're not supposed to be disclosing what you heard. It's confidential information. You're on warning, you do it again. He does it again, gets fired. If I understand the Department of Labor theory here, that employee has a Sarbanes-Oxley Act whistleblower protection suit.
Your Honor, the Secretary of Labor recognizes that a limiting...
Is the answer yes or no?
I really would not want to speculate on behalf of the Secretary since this has not come up before the Secretary of Labor.
But the argument has been made that your interpretation would lead to overly broad results, which Congress surely didn't intend. And so I just gave you a hypothetical. There are 100 of them, but it does seem to me you have to reply to that argument.
Your Honor, the Act only requires that a public company or its contractor is not permitted to retaliate against an employee who engages in any lawful act to provide information or assist an investigation of conduct that the employee reasonably believes constitutes a violation of certain specific four criminal fraud acts.
But you know, in the Day case, we had an employee totally untutored in the securities laws who on his own formed a passionate belief that what the company was doing was a violation of the securities laws. And he sued under Sarbanes-Oxley when the company terminated him because they were unhappy with his performance, including the fact that he, from their point of view, he continually misinterpreted what he was hearing. It does seem to me the Secretary's position sort of opens up the door to a lot of those sorts of lawsuits that do seem pretty far afield from what Congress was concerned with.
Your Honor, this Court did hold in Day v. Staples that although the employee may have had a subjectively reasonable belief that a violation had occurred, he did not have an objectively reasonable belief.
Right, but a lawsuit was filed and everyone had to incur the expense of going through that litigation, and it took a judicial finding in the end that it was not objectively reasonable. The Secretary's you may be right, but the Secretary's position encourages a lot of litigation. And one question is whether Congress wanted to encourage that type of litigation.
It's important, Your Honor, I believe, to read this in the context, what the purpose of the statute was, and reading it in that context, one would look at this.
But you stood up here and you rejected Judge Woodlock's narrowing principle. That was the second part of your argument.
Yes,
so you can't do that, right? You can't have it both ways.
We don't think that relating to fraud against shareholders is a necessary element of protected activity in all cases, because we don't think the criminal fraud statutes are limited just to shareholder fraud. Thank you.
Thank you. That was helpful. Mr. Nemser.
Just two quick points, Your Honor. Counsel for the Department of Labor was just saying that there would be a gaping hole, and if this statute did not apply in this instance, and I wanted to point out to the Court that there is a provision in the Dodd-Frank Act that does provide some whistleblower, actually provides bounties in certain circumstances for blowing the whistle. It also says that for people who make certain kinds of reports to the SEC and other people, there's whistleblower protection, and so at least going forward after Dodd-Frank, in certain circumstances, there may be some coverage. And there's also a criminal provision with respect to reports to law enforcement authorities, and neither of those is limited to employees of public companies like Section 806 is. And finally, on Johnson v. Siemens, the ARB decision that counsel was just mentioning, if you look at that case, it goes on for pages to discuss what was really the issue there, which is whether the Dodd-Frank amendment was essentially retroactive and changed the law, or whether it was a clarification. That's what that case was about. At the tail end of it, there's some dicta about under what circumstances a subsidiary might be an agent. Dicta aren't entitled to deference, Skidmore or otherwise. And if anything, as I was arguing a minute ago, Dodd-Frank indicates that Congress paid attention and spoke in a situation where there was a conflict as to the subsidiary issue and said, we want to cover these subsidiaries, and exactly the opposite happened with respect to the privately held contractors or subcontractors at issue here. Thank you.
Thank you. I will say it's been a pleasure for the court to hear such very fine arguments. Thank you.